Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
In building a better California.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans this weekend woke up to a sobering reality. The war in Afghanistan is not over. The Pentagon said today 9 U.S. soldiers have been killed in the latest fighting in by far the largest battle deployment yet of U.S. ground forces in Afghanistan. The casualties came as the U.S. joined friendly Afghan forces and allied units again, this time to put down hundreds of Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters who had regrouped in eastern Afghanistan. I spoke earlier today with Steve Inskeep. He's a correspondent with National Public Radio. I asked him what U.S. officials are saying about the fighting in Afghanistan.
Officials here at the Pentagon are saying they're going to continue fighting until the enemy is completely destroyed or has surrendered, and they're going to continue fighting despite the heaviest casualties that the United States has suffered in combat in this war. Several Americans have died when American helicopters came under fire as they attempted to drop troops into the battlefield. Now, Tom, this is described to us as a very large battlefield, about 60 square miles of extremely rugged, mountainous, snow-covered terrain. There are small groups of suspected Taliban or al-Qaeda fighters who are hiding in those mountains, sometimes moving around, sometimes defending strong points such as caves or hilltops. And as the U.S. closes in on each of these small groups, they're kind of hopscotching around the battlefield by helicopter. On a couple of occasions, though, U.S. helicopters have tried to land while taking hostile fire. We're told that there were a couple of perhaps related incidents within the last 24 to 36 hours. A U.S. helicopter was in the process of putting a reconnaissance team down when it turned out that there were enemy troops very close by. They opened fire. They hit the helicopter. The helicopter was able to lift up and get away, but a crew member fell out of the helicopter, we're told, as it was escaping, and the rest of the crew did not realize that their fellow soldier was missing until it was too late. By the time the U.S. forces got back to that soldier, he was dead, either from the fall or from enemy fire. We don't know. A short time later, the U.S. sent many more forces into that same area, having located the enemy, and another helicopter was struck and damaged, apparently disabled, as it was going in for a landing. It did manage to make an upright landing, a safe landing, but then the U.S. forces poured out of that and into an intense firefight, and we're told that either in the hard landing or else in the shooting that followed, several more Americans died. Overall, 8 to 9 Americans have been killed in the fighting over the last several days.
Steve, do you have a sense of how many troops are on the ground on both sides of this conflict?
This is not a gigantic battle by any means, although by Afghan standards, it's relatively large. There are about 2,000 troops, we're told, on the U.S. and Afghan side, a little less than 1,000 U.S. forces and a little more than 1,000 of their Afghan allies involved. That includes some U.S. special operations troops and also, for the first time, regular infantry soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division and from the 10th Mountain Division are engaging in combat here. They're going after several hundred, perhaps 200 to 400, Pentagon officials say, Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters, many of whom the U.S. military contends have now been killed over the last several days of fighting, although the remainder continue to resist.
But 1,000 U.S. troops on the ground is a big step up from what we've seen in other Afghan operations. Why so many more U.S. troops this time?
It is a dramatic change, and U.S. military officials are avoiding saying that they've tried to change their strategy here, but it is instructive to look at some other things that they've done in somewhat similar situations. You may recall, Tom, that in December, the U.S. believed that it had a number of Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters surrounded in the Tora Bora cave complex. The U.S. used its air power in that instance, but mainly relied on Afghan fighters to try to surround those caves and attack them and search out enemy fighters. In the end, that did not work all that well. It appeared that most of the al-Qaeda fighters simply disappeared. They got away. The enemy evaporated. And in this instance, we see something different being tried. The U.S. is unwilling to say that they've learned their lesson and tried a different strategy, but the fact is that they are trying a somewhat different approach in this particular situation, upping the number of U.S. forces who are engaged.
We're going to be hearing later in this hour about
how Osama bin Laden reportedly escaped from Tora Bora. But I wonder about these al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters regrouping here. How did they regroup? Why did they regroup if it made them a target, which it obviously has?
That's something of a mystery. And of course, we should point out that they certainly haven't held a press conference to say why they were regrouping, Tom.
Not.
But U.S. military officials have their own ideas. Some are suggesting that they were regrouping in this area, perhaps with an eye toward continuing their attacks. And when Taliban officials have made public statements in the past, that is exactly what they said they would do. When they abandoned the major cities in November and December, they said it was a strategic withdrawal and that they would regroup in the countryside and perhaps come back for guerrilla attacks. So it is possible that what you saw was fighters grouping for that purpose. But the other possibility laid out by U.S. officials was simply that these guys were trying to hide. And some of the evidence might point to that. There were not several hundred Taliban fighters, as far as we know, gathered in a single place, taking orders or making plans or anything else. They were scattered in a variety of strong points throughout the countryside and had kept themselves hidden there for quite a number of weeks. U.S. forces had observed them there for several weeks. So we do not know that they were specifically planning an attack from there. We do know that they were trying to stay concealed there as long as possible.
Why has this been such a tough operation? Is it the terrain or the quality of arms that these troops have, or just the skill of the Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters? What's made it so tough this time?
This is exceedingly difficult terrain, and that is true almost anywhere in Afghanistan. This has got to be one of the roughest countries in the world, and it's made even worse by the complete lack of good roads and the extremely bad weather. My NPR colleague, John Burnett, who has been across a great deal of this ground over the last several days, or in the vicinity of it anyway, observes that this is an area that has always been naturally easy to defend because of the caves, because of the roughness of the mountainous terrain, because of the difficulty of getting in there with a large force. And in fact, in the 1980s, when there were Afghan guerrillas fighting against the Soviet army, the Afghan guerrillas sometimes would retreat to these caves and these strong points and fight against the Russians from there, and the Russians had great difficulty dislodging them. So you now have Afghan fighters retreating to a similar area, and while the U.S. is claiming some success in getting Afghans out of there and in killing the enemy, U.S. officials make no secret about the fact that they're having great difficulty getting in there.
What does the future look like, Steve? Are we going to see continued operations like this over time, or are we mopping up the last bits of this problem?
U.S. officials are saying that this is not necessarily a last stand for the al-Qaeda. There is no specific evidence, for example, to indicate that Osama bin Laden is hiding in one of those caves or one of those strong points. Who knows? Maybe U.S. officials will find out he is, but they're saying they have no intelligence that they're willing to share to indicate such a thing. So bin Laden is still missing somewhere. Mullah Omar is still missing somewhere. A number of other top Taliban officials are still somewhere, perhaps in Afghanistan, perhaps outside. No one has specific information about it. And so U.S. officials are saying the war is not over, and it's not going to be over even after they finish this particular offensive. They're going to continue to search for what they consider to be remnants of the Taliban or al-Qaeda anywhere they can find them.
Steve Inskeep is a correspondent with National Public Radio. 9 American soldiers lost and another 40 wounded in the past 3 days of fighting in Afghanistan. The casualties announced today mark the highest number of American soldiers killed in a single action since the war on terrorism began last October. Military analysts are describing this new level of fighting on the ground, gun to gun, as a taste of the next phase of the war on terror. And they say that routing the Taliban and al-Qaeda forces from all their nooks and crannies will be a bloody fight that could take years. Is America ready for this bloodier new phase in the war on terrorism? Did you think the war was already over? Is the U.S. mopping up or digging in Afghanistan? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now is Barry Posen. He's professor of political science at MIT and author of The Sources of Military Doctrine and The Inadvertent Escalation. Good evening and welcome, Barry Posen.
Good evening.
Barry Posen, let me put the question straight to you. Is this operation a sign that the United States is mopping up or digging in Afghanistan?
I think it's impossible to answer that question because the number of facts that we have about what the original size of the al-Qaeda force was versus what's been captured and what's been killed almost non-existent. So it really is quite difficult to tell.
We just don't know the size of the remaining force.
Well, the American military, the American intelligence community may have a better idea, but they haven't been sharing a lot of facts with us. So it's very difficult for us to judge whether this is essentially al-Qaeda's last great stand or whether this is sort of the beginning of a new phase in which we could find American soldiers and their Afghan allies fighting one of these a week, a month, every couple months. It's very hard to say.
Of course, there's no guarantee that this opposition force will be static in its number. It could still be recruiting.
Well, it's possible. It's possible. I guess I would put it this way. I think it's unlikely that people from all over the world are still able to flock to Pakistan and then go across the border into Afghanistan and receive training and become fighters. And I think it's even unlikely that veteran fighters that are somewhere else can somehow get into Pakistan and then get easily into this country. Some will, but I think it's unlikely that you'll see more. But I think the problem is there were a good many al-Qaeda people there when this all started, and it's not clear just really how many of them have been killed. And, of course, there were thousands of people who fought on the side of the Taliban, and we don't have thousands of Taliban dead, and we don't have thousands of Taliban prisoners. Mm-hmm. And it seems possible that some of those people are also involved in this, and those people could keep regenerating. I mean, there's plenty of gunmen in Afghanistan that have fought on one or both sides, many sides, and it's entirely possible that at least some of them would flock to this cause, or if not flock, rise to this cause depending on some circumstances. So I think that you're right that the force is not entirely static, but I think it's probably the Afghan part of the force that has the greatest possibility of regenerating, not the al-Qaeda part.
And Barry Posen, what do you make of this latest round of fighting? Are you surprised that it suddenly burst on the scene?
I can't say that I'm surprised. I think it's almost, it's wrong to say it's universally agreed, but I think there's a good deal of consensus that the early ground fights with Taliban and al-Qaeda were not very successful, culminating in the Tora Bora fight.
So last fall and into winter.
I mean, the Taliban was broken as a conventional military, mm-hmm. and control over the cities was lost by the Taliban to the United Front. But those operations didn't have the mark of a decisive victory. You didn't catch up thousands and thousands of prisoners. You captured some weapons, but mm-hmm. you didn't catch up thousands and thousands of prisoners. So there was reason to suspect a lot of people exfiltrated, and there was reason to suspect that at the time.
Exfiltrated, a wonderful word.
Okay. And the journalistic community, I think, has done a lot of digging since the Tora Bora fight, and I think they've turned up significant evidence that that fight didn't go as well as America would have liked at best, and at worst was somehow mismanaged in some way.
So who do you think has gathered in this high plain south of Gardez? Are these Afghans? Are they non-Afghans? Are they Taliban? Are they al-Qaeda? All of the above?
Well, judging from the statements by the briefers today, it sounds like all of the above, but the emphasis in their conversation seems to be on al-Qaeda. In other words, that these are mostly foreign fighters, some of whom were closer to al-Qaeda, others of whom were closer to the former Taliban regime. But it sounds like they're talking mostly foreigners, but with a scattering of Afghans, including some past Taliban leaders. And why these people are gathering in this area is another question, and how they were able to gather successfully, why they're so heavily armed, so well prepared, et cetera, et cetera. These are all the issues.
Mm-hmm. And 1,000 U.S. ground troops on the ground, including infantry for the first time.
Yeah, judging from the simple arithmetic of the situation, it sounds to me like they expected to find as many as 500 or 600 fighters there, and they built up a force that was roughly large enough to deal with a force of 500 or 600 fighters.
But interestingly, not the formula we saw at Tora Bora, with just a few Americans spotting, bringing in the bombing runs while Afghans did the fighting.
Yeah, I think they wanted to be sure, or they wanted to do the best job they could to see that nobody escaped from this. And the best way to do that is to have some ground forces of your own in there who you can order to prosecute the adversary very aggressively. And I think that's why we probably have, I'm betting, two U.S. infantry battalions in there. My guess is that's what this constitutes, one from the 10th Mountain Division, one from the 101st.
And that means casualties.
Well, invariably, almost invariably, when you put infantry within the range of somebody else's infantry weapons, some of your own people are going to suffer. In a way, you could argue that the casualties have been surprisingly light.
We're talking tonight about the return of war, bloody war, in Afghanistan. Are you heartened or frightened to see more U.S. troops fighting on the ground? Did you think the war was already over, already won? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Several news stories have suggested that the current fighting in Afghanistan could be al-Qaeda's last stand. But in a press conference earlier today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said any talk of final battles is premature.
I think that it would be an incorrect reading of the situation to think that this would be the last stand. I say that because it has, as we've said repeatedly, and I hope it sinks into everybody, that it is in that country, it's what, bigger than Texas, and with borders to four, five, six countries. It is very easy to move across borders and then come back in. It's very easy to slip into the mountains, into tunnels and caves and stay there for periods. It's very easy to blend into the countryside, into the villages, and then come back and reconstitute. So the thought that all of the people, all of the Taliban who oppose the interim government that now exists, that Karzai is leading, all of the al-Qaeda are gone and disappeared or changed their minds or gone benign, I think is just unrealistic. I think we have to expect that there are other sizable pockets, that there will be other battles of this type.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in a press briefing earlier today. We're joined tonight by Barry Posen. He's professor of political science at MIT and author of The Inadvertent Escalation. We're talking about the return to hot war in Afghanistan. What do you think? Are we mopping up or digging in Afghanistan? And if it takes a while, as Donald Rumsfeld says it may, does the United States have the stomach for a long Afghan war? Do we need a long Afghan war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barry Posen, is the action going on now a kind of inevitable tail to what went on last fall, or is it a sign that there were errors made in what went on in the U.S. operations in Afghanistan last fall?
I'd like to give you a direct answer, but I think it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
I think mistakes were made. I mean, it's easy to say these things with hindsight.
Of course.
And, of course, we were waging war on the fly. It's a mm-hmm. little bit different kind of war. There's lots
coming
of
out of an emotional beginning
and
everything else.
You were at war very shortly after the September 11th. There's only so much time to prepare.
But still, we'd like to learn from that experience.
But I think it's clear that at least it's clear to me that in most of the principal fights that happened, Mazar-e-Sharif, Kunduz, Kabul, Kandahar, and Tora Bora, that for whatever reasons, not enough energy was put into rounding up the bad guys as they tried to get out of those places. And some of them may have fought in several of those places and got out several times. We'd have been better off had we put more energy into it. That said, right, given the numbers, their elusiveness, and their degree of mm-hmm. preparation, I think you would have still been in a situation where you would be continuing to prosecute those groups.
Why do you think the U.S. didn't put more troops on the ground in November, December, when they had concentrations of al-Qaeda surrounded? Was it a political calculation that we just didn't want the casualties then, that we wanted a kind of run-and-gun victory that would satisfy the nation's need for that? That it was working, that at some level our allies were moving into Kabul, all of the above again.
Your hypotheses are as good as mine. It is possible that we didn't have sufficient ground forces in the area. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true because we're talking about battalions, not divisions, for the kinds of operations that were there. So I think there probably were enough ground forces around. There was a concern that was often expressed by General Franks that we didn't want to, by an excess amount of American forces to suggest to the Afghans that we were a new Soviet occupier, that we were coming to conquer them. I personally don't think that there was that much risk of that, but that's what he says. I think there's anytime you start a new military operation, to start any military operation requires a certain amount of nerve, even when you sure. significantly outclass the other guy. And I think there was some sense in which The military knew it was fighting and learning and learning and fighting at the same time in the early phases of this. So they were going in a little bit gingerly in some places, particularly with ground forces. You may recall that they were actually quite slow to insert special forces teams into Afghanistan. They inserted them rather slowly and in relatively small numbers. I mean, surprising how few special forces people were required to turn things in favor of the United Front / Northern Alliance.
And in fact, this was presented as a kind of new formula, a few Americans on the ground drawing in the high-tech airborne firepower.
Right. And to some extent, it worked. But what's missing in a situation like that is enough forces on the ground to saturate the space, to control the space. And we were relying on United Front to control the space, and they weren't particularly large either. So there was a lot of uncontrolled space through which Al-Qaeda folks who decided to live to fight another day could themselves exfiltrate. Right? And, of course, we did have this bad episode when there was the prison uprising, and there's some reason to suspect that some Al-Qaeda people even got away there
in that fight.
Yeah. So there were lots of problems and obstacles and concerns, and all of which I think suggested to the Americans a rather cautious form of warfare, maybe a tad too cautious. It's easy for us sitting here to say it was too cautious because we didn't have to march up those hills and breathe that thin air and take the bullets.
Right.
But nevertheless, it still looks a little cautious. And because of that, some people whom you would have rather not have gotten away got away, including Osama bin Laden.
And on the bigger issue of whether we're mopping up or digging in, to avoid the kind of Soviet engagement with Afghanistan, which was long and bloody and ultimately fruitless, is there any risk of these remaining Taliban, Al-Qaeda troops, call them what you will, finding allies among disaffected warlords in Afghanistan that we feel so much about? Could we find them actually gaining adherence in the old Afghan pattern of allegiances shifting and turning constantly? Is there a danger of the U.S. finding itself up against a growing force comprised of warlords who turn against Karzai, who turn against the United States, and turn this into a Soviet-style quagmire?
I think there's a risk that Al-Qaeda and Taliban remnants will find each other and coalesce a bit. I think that they have some problems now that are far greater than the problems that the Afghans faced vis-a-vis the Soviets. First of all, they don't have a great power ally. The Afghans against the Soviets had a great power ally to supply them with weapons.
That would have been us.
That would have been us. Second, we've been both skillful and lucky in separating them from their Pakistan ally. And I think that's probably getting better all the time. Musharraf seems to be cleaning house in the Pakistani intelligence services. So that's a point in our favor. Third, we have really large sums of money to spend in this country. And if we have to put everybody on the payroll to keep control of the place, well, then we will. And fourth, it's always dangerous to show too much pride in your capabilities, but our capabilities are, I think, significantly better in many important ways than what the Soviets have, and I think all of that redounds to our favor. But you can't forget that a lot of these people are very motivated, and that they did amass a fair amount of cash, and that small arms, the kind of weapons that they use, rifles, machine guns, RPGs, and mortars, are incredibly cheap and seem to grow in the ground in that part of the world.
We're talking with Barry Posen about the renewed hot war in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Feroz is on the line. Good evening and welcome, Feroz.
Thank you very much.
You're on the air. Fire away, my friend.
Yeah, I have had the capacity of the chance of serving in that area as a physician, and I went only as far as Jalalabad. I just wanted to make a couple of few quick points.
Well, wait, you have our attention already, Feroz. With whom were you a physician?
Yeah, I was a physician in Pakistan at that time, and during the course of my training, we went to humanitarian camp in Jalalabad and stayed there for a while.
Okay.
And my impression is, first of all, that people in the United States think that Al-Qaeda is some sort of a multinational corporation which has offices and office bearers, but it is not. This is their greatest strength and their greatest weakness at the same time.
So how does it look to you, Feroz?
It is looks to me like a skewed and a distorted version of some Islamic fanaticism to which seems appealing to those people who have nothing to look forward to. And that is the breeding ground for these fanatics. And unless this military warfare is followed by a more costly and more expensive psychological warfare, to have these people submit to us psychologically, I think a Soviet sort of an engagement is inevitable. You know?
Feroz, do you think that there's a danger of the numbers of those opposing the U.S. in Afghanistan might actually grow over time?
My personal feeling is it depends whether this military onslaught is followed by a psychological warfare or not, or a propaganda warfare or not. If it's solely a military engagement, this is the way Afghans have fought over the centuries. You know, they have never, ever in the history fought a pitched battle.
And what's the psychological message that would get through and win support of the American presence, or at least the Karzai government backed by the United States?
Tom, if I can call you with your first name, mm-hmm. My opinion is what those guys are afraid of the most is education. I'm not kidding you, but I think those guys are more afraid of modern education than they are afraid of tanks or aircraft flying with the head.
And by those guys, you mean Al-Qaeda?
Absolutely.
Feroz, thanks very much for your call. Barry Posen, let me put that to you. Feroz is pointing out what he describes as the limits of military power to solve this problem. Your thoughts?
Well, it depends on the problem. If it were the United States' purpose to conquer, occupy, re-engineer Afghanistan, I think he'd be on very strong ground, because I think it's going to be a very hard thing to do. I don't think it's impossible, given what our objectives are in Afghanistan, which are pretty limited, to essentially buy a lot of friends in that area. A lot of people in that country weren't that happy with the former regime. So I think that's point one. The second problem is really the problem of Al-Qaeda, which is different. Surely there are people in Afghanistan who are very friendly to Al-Qaeda, people in Pakistan who are friendly to Al-Qaeda, and people in many other countries who are friendly to Al-Qaeda. And those people, that movement is going to have to be fought in a variety of ways in a variety of countries. And, of course, we can't control events in 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 countries at once. So a good deal of what needs to be done is in the nature of intelligence operations and whatnot. There probably are some things that need to be done to win political support for the Americans and the United States in that part of the world, and it's not clear to me that we're ready to do all those things yet.
Such as?
Well, I think we have to work harder to try and settle up with the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. I think that it's not what It's not why Osama bin Laden is fighting the Americans. He's got bigger reasons to fight the Americans, but it's a propaganda tool that he uses. And we're going to have to figure out something to do with Iraq, and I'm not sure the current plan, which is to escalate a war, is exactly the smartest way to proceed. But I think this point about education is important, and essentially somehow, some ways, these countries have to set up an educational competitor for these fundamentalist Islamic madrasa schools that help produce new generations of really
recruits.
Fanatical warriors.
Feroz, thanks for your call. Barry Posen, stand by. We're joined now by Jay Farrar. He's Vice President for External Affairs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He was 22 years in the U.S. Marine Corps. Good evening and welcome, Jay Farrar.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Jay Farrar, how do you read the renewed fighting in Afghanistan, and what does it tell us about the way that the war was prosecuted by the United States last fall and winter?
I think it was an opportune prosecution that we conducted last fall and winter, and it was one based on a sound indication that it was the best way to go at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you inevitably pay a price later on, and I don't think anybody was surprised by what's happening now, mm-hmm. especially in uniform. So I think they took advantage of what the situation presented, and knowing that something was going to come later on, and now we're paying that greater price, and I think we will for the foreseeable future unless we see these forces fold more quickly. But as Barry's pointed out, most of these people can slip in and out of these regions quickly without us being able to get them. And I don't know that even if we put a tremendous number of ground forces in there, you could really stop it any better. I think this is going to be a little bit of slugging it out in the foreseeable future.
So does that mean an open-ended U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and continuing casualties and reports of renewed fighting every few weeks? Are we in this for the long haul, Jay Farrar?
I think we're in it for a longer haul than people were coming to believe. And by that, I mean, this is not something that's going to be wrapped up in 3 or 4 more months. This is going to be a year, 18 months to 2 years, I think, total, before we have the kind of stability that allows us to step back, so to speak, and take a little bit of a refocus or a breather to look at other issues.
Mm-hmm. Benyam is on the line right now. Benyam, welcome. You're on the air. Hello, Benyam. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit perplexed because none of the distinguished guests had mentioned anything about the Caspian Sea oil or Russia and all these geostrategic significance of Afghanistan, for instance. In fact, my particular take on this situation is that as long as the regime of Hamid Karzai is seen as a puppet or very weak in Afghanistan, then the presence of the United States is very necessary. Particularly if we recall that his regime is basically the Northern Alliance, which are just as notorious as the Taliban, in which case the Afghan people have been caught sort of in a limbo.
Benyam, let me put that to Barry Posen. Barry Posen, obviously we've seen that the Karzai regime, while they've played very well on the world stage, have something less than thorough control of this country, a lot less than thorough control. What do you think of Benyam's observation that until there's a government solidly in place in Kabul, the U.S. is going to have to be there militarily?
I think the Karzai government is going to need a lot of support from the U.S. and from a lot of other people. I think that's probably true. I think what remains to be seen is sort of what's the right strategy for trying to hold this country together. And it's not clear to me that creating a truly strong central government is really the right strategy, because you're invariably going to make angry one or other of the major groups in the countryside. So it seems to me that they're going to have to develop some sort of confederal kind of system. It doesn't have to be, written down constitutionally, but there's got to be some balance of power among the groups in the society. Otherwise, there's going to be bloody war.
And Jay Farrar, how do you see this playing out politically? And as Benyam pointed out, the resource issues here, the desire in some quarters to put an oil pipeline across Afghanistan, what's going to keep conflict burning and what's going to favor peace?
Well, first of all, I think Americans have a tendency to want to oversimplify the situation and make it basically a good guy versus bad guy, and it's not. As Barry has said, it's a very complex equation. I agree completely with what he's saying, that it's maybe not the best thing to just install or try to install a central government, which Afghanistan has never known with any degree of confidence or support. And your caller, with respect to the resource issues that Afghanistan sits in the middle of, is very correct. So it is a complex issue that just a military action is not going to solve. This is just one little piece of this greater puzzle. And the reality is the U.S., with help from a lot of other people, a lot of other countries, is going to have to be patient and work this complex issue to try and find the right solution.
Do you see the non-military pieces of this being put into place, Jay, in the few seconds we have left here?
No, not in the near term. It's going to be a long-term struggle.
Jay Farrar is Vice President for External Affairs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Jay Farrar, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
We're talking about a return to hot war in Afghanistan. And the question is, are we mopping up or digging in? It's sounding like, as Barry Posen says, we may be doing both. At the same time, this is not going to be quick, everyone's saying today. What do you think? Does the United States have the stomach for a long Afghan war? Do we need a long Afghan war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a return to hot war in Afghanistan, the largest number of ground troops yet deployed, the largest number of U.S. casualties just in the last couple of days. Did you think the war was already won, already over? Are we mopping up or digging in Afghanistan? Might we be in Afghanistan for the long haul? After all, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Barry Posen. He's professor of political science at MIT. And Shami is on the line. Welcome, Shami. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for taking my call. Good to have you.
I'm originally from the tribal area next to that where this war is going on.
Okay.
So if you look at the map, Afghanistan encircles that area in a U shape. In the north, it's Tora Bora. In the west, it's Gardez. And in the south, it's Khost.
Yes.
So these people are ethnically Pashtun. And if you look at the history of Afghanistan, like past 25, 30 years history, these people have been very active in either Red Revolution or during the kingdom.
So we know there's a history of warfare, but what do you see going on there right now, Shami?
That Afghanistan, in that area, when United States starts bombing, so they made some mistakes over there, like especially in Khost, when these people are going to greet Karzai on his inauguration, and their convoy was bombed. So there has been bombing going on, and United States made mistakes. Mostly these people are Pashtun. There are not many Al-Qaeda people over there. And I was listening to BBC, and the correspondent to BBC, Mr. Yousafzai, he said the same thing, that only Taliban are in majority over there, not the Al-Qaeda people, not the Arab people.
So you're suggesting that this is not hardcore Al-Qaeda fighters, but just locals who got bombed by accident and they're angry? It sounds like a pretty big battle for that kind of resistance, Shami.
No, these are hardcore Taliban people because they were in ministries during Taliban regime. There were six people from this particular area in the Taliban regime, in the higher ministries.
Let me put that to Barry Posen, Shami. Thanks for your call. Barry, do we know exactly who this is, and what does it matter exactly if it's Al-Qaeda or former Taliban or just angry Pashtun people who got bombed on their way to the Karzai inauguration?
Well, there are no doubt some angry Pashtun people who were inadvertently bombed. But I actually think it's quite difficult from the reports we've heard to know, you know, what percentage of the people that are fighting against the Americans in this particular situation are foreigners or non-Afghan, and what percent are Afghan.
Does it matter in terms of the ongoing threat?
It probably doesn't matter yet, but ultimately it will matter. At some point, I think the United States and the Karzai government are going to have to essentially call it quits on Taliban. In other words,
over. We're done with that.
There were a lot of people who were associates with Taliban. Right. Some were opportunists. Some were hardcore. It's clear we're having a hard time running down the leaders. That's because they have a lot of friends. If the effort to chase the last Taliban leader means we have to, you know, kill a lot of Afghans and make more enemies, at some point this problem is going to turn inside itself. I mean, our objective in country, it seems to me, has to be to try and separate Al-Qaeda from Taliban. Now, it's not going to be easy to do. There are some groups of Taliban that were very close to Al-Qaeda, and from time to time we're going to have to make some choices. If these groups are together, you know, do you want to...
But you don't want to make ongoing enemies of Afghan ethnic groups or any kind of political stripe, ultimately.
Some of that is bound to happen, but you want to try and limit it. And the U.S. government is not saying it yet, and I've heard no inkling of it. But it just seems to me that it's inevitable that at some point we're going to have to let it be known that we've accomplished what we wanted to accomplish against the Taliban regime. We're happy with anybody in Afghanistan, but we're not happy with foreigners in Afghanistan. And that's all we need. Right, and it seems to me
Taliban stand down, come home, go to work, join the new regime.
Do whatever you're going to do, right? But it's the foreigners that we want, because it's the foreigners who ultimately are the potential recruits for flying airplanes into buildings and doing other terrible things.
Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest if he thought that Pakistan would let us supply troops to round up Al-Qaeda that have moved into Pakistan, should that become obvious that it needs to be done?
Good question. Thank you, Bruce. Barry Posen?
No. I don't think Pakistan is ever going to invite American troops into that country.
Will they deal aggressively themselves with Al-Qaeda who crossed the border?
They have done some things. They've picked up some of them. The Pakistani government their attitude seems to be, if there were Pakistani supporters of the Taliban regime, then they're going to treat them somewhat gently, it seems. But if they're non-Pakistani, non-Afghan supporters of the Taliban regime, they seem to be willing to, or Al-Qaeda, they seem to be willing to pick them up and share them with us. And
is there a risk of Pakistan becoming the off-limits base of Al-Qaeda coming back into Afghanistan, sort of Cambodia, Vietnam style?
I think that there's a risk, but it's not a case where the Pakistan government is going to be the big source of the support. The problem is that there are Pashtuns living on both sides of the border. Many of them are sympathetic to al-Qaeda, right? So the border exists in our minds and on our maps, but it doesn't necessarily exist in their minds.
But it exists in the U.S. military's mind because it's a different country and they're not permitted there.
Because it's a different country. But I think they're going to have to try and get the Pakistanis to do what they can, right? But there is going to be some inevitable sanctuary possibility for some of these people in Pakistan, I think.
Mm-hmm. Brian is on the line. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
The point that I wanted to make is that I just don't see the sense in troops continuing to hit the ground with guns blazing while this administration continues to resist putting in any kind of a peacekeeping force of our troops.
Do you mean U.S. troops participating in peacekeeping?
Yes. I mean, the Afghan people on the street, from what I can tell from the media anyway, all seem to support a peacekeeping presence, including U.S. troops.
We've seen those reports. Brian, thank you for your call. Barry Posen, is it possible that a greater peacekeeping presence would limit the need for this kind of hot military engagement? Is that a seesaw?
I don't think so. Look, this is a very big country, and the number of people, the number of peacekeepers you would really need to keep peace in places in these kinds of corners of the country, you know, outside of the major urban centers, it's huge. I mean, we're running into thousands of remember, they were originally put 60,000 peacekeepers into Kosovo. It's a very tiny place.
This place
is huge. Now, it may or may not be true that, you know, more peacekeepers in some of the major urban centers of this area fanning out a little bit can make life better for a lot of people. But peacekeepers are not going to get into this part of the country and do anything different from what the American forces have to do, which
is 11,000-foot mountains. Yeah, they're not going to be hanging out
there. You have to – if you don't want al-Qaeda people to reconstitute in this country, if you don't want them to have a sanctuary in this country, then you probably have to go after them.
Barry Posen, real quick, we've just got a minute left. Does the U.S. have the political stomach to stick with this until it's done, whatever done means?
I don't know what done means, but I think the public will support an open-ended campaign to try and suppress the people that are identified with the September 11th attacks.
You don't have any doubt about that?
No, I don't.
Barry Posen is professor of political science at MIT, author of The Sources of Military Doctrine and The Inadvertent Escalation. Barry, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
As the United States faces an unknown number of regrouping Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters, one question plagues many in the administration. How did the most wanted man in the world get away from the most sophisticated military in the world? Philip Smucker is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He's been in Afghanistan for months on the trail of Osama bin Laden. I spoke with him earlier today, and I asked how bin Laden got away.
Well, he'd been in Jalalabad, a long-time base. He knew a lot of people there. A lot of people believe that last video where he was boasting about how much pleasure he'd taken in the World Trade Center collapse was made in Jalalabad.
And this, of course, is in eastern Afghanistan.
Indeed, yeah. And then he gathered the tribal leaders together a few days before the big exodus from Jalalabad with several hundred, possibly 1,500 Arabs and Chechens leaving Jalalabad, headed out in the direction of Tora Bora. So he had laid the groundwork in Jalalabad, meeting with Pakistani and Afghan tribal leaders.
Okay. Do you know when he left Jalalabad and went to Tora Bora?
Yes, the big meeting with the tribal chiefs that was on December 10th. It was in the Taliban intelligence headquarters after a big meal. And then 3 days later, everybody got in the convoy 2 days before the fall of the Taliban in Jalalabad. Everybody gathered in the south edge of town with their large SUVs. There were a few armored cars. Bin Laden himself was in a large Toyota Corolla. And they prepared to leave. And they left even as the city was being bombed. So even as there was bombing elsewhere in the city, this huge convoy snaked out of Jalalabad in the direction of Tora Bora and actually got into Tora Bora and positioned themselves over the next 24 hours with relative ease. They stayed there, which it's about 30 miles south of Jalalabad, and it's very close to actually borders with Pakistan. So it's a good place to keep one foot in Afghanistan and the other foot in Pakistan. And so I think bin Laden goaded on his own fighters to fight a last stand while at the same time keeping in the back of his head the fact that he had paid off the Pakistani tribal leaders and had an exit route paved with money already into Pakistan.
So how many days was Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora with his fighters before he moved on? And what was his interaction with his fighters while he was in the caves there?
Well, I don't know if you remember, there was a report that made a lot of waves in the monitor that I wrote at one point from a Saudi financier who had ridden with bin Laden into Tora Bora. And he contended that bin Laden had traveled out of Tora Bora once with al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian, his right-hand man, and then bin Laden had on his own come back. And so his interaction actually was quite limited with the troops on the ground. The troops did see him, however, on about the 26th of November, still the second week in Ramadan. He came in for tea in many of the caves to, as it were, bid farewell. He met with a lot of his fighters, Yemenis in particular. And then in the next two or three, 4 days, according to the detailed accounts, or numerous accounts, I should say, from the fighters as well as the Afghans, he left then on foot, reportedly with four other people. And they were armed, and it's not clear whether they were guards, actual al-Qaeda members, or Afghans. But he went out in the direction of Parachinar. He made it. He called back into the camp, and he said that he would be sending his son in.
Philip Smucker, at that time, the U.S. bombardment of Tora Bora was well underway, was it not? And weren't there a lot of American forces around? Why wasn't he spotted?
Yes, indeed. The bombing had been ongoing because Tora Bora was a notorious terror base. But the Americans were bombing heavily, and mainly on one side of Tora Bora, which came as a shock to some of the locals around the area, because they thought that maybe the Americans were trying to frighten the al-Qaeda members out and chase them away, because they didn't put the ground troops down for a good 2 weeks. Now, Vice President Cheney said, well, almost to the day bin Laden was meeting for tea with a lot of his fighters before he left 4 days later, the Pentagon came out and said, well, we think he's probably either down in Kandahar or we believe he's up there in Tora Bora. They seem to have a bead on him before he'd left. I'm not second-guessing the U.S. military, but the Afghans were rather astounded that, given the fact that Tora Bora only has several escape routes, it's not as porous as was described in the Pentagon. There's only several major ways to leave, and it's a small area. They were basically within a few kilometers of each other.
In retrospect, Philip Smucker, did the U.S. military make mistakes, and what were the fundamental mistakes that led to bin Laden getting away, walking away into Pakistan and out of the clutches of the U.S. effort?
Well, the worst mistake, I suppose, was the assumption by a lot of people in the Pentagon that the Afghan fighters had the same interest that we did, or in fact that the interest of the Afghans in liberating their own country coincided with our interest in taking out al-Qaeda. And in fact, the Afghans were on the take, many of them.
Philip Smucker, you've looked so closely at Osama bin Laden's last days in Afghanistan and at his escape. From that scrutiny, what does it tell you about how he is likely to have behaved after he escaped and what he's likely to be doing now?
Well, I was talking to a few military analysts, and I think that I side with the ones that say that this is a very clever man. It would be wrong to underestimate his guile and ability to escape and evade. There were a lot of places and a lot of options, and he knew a lot of people. He had a lot of friends.
Philip Smucker is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke with him earlier today from his home in Cairo. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think about the U.S. military's latest action in Afghanistan. Send your email to onpoint@wbur.org or mail us a letter. The address is onpoint, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.